Welcome to the podcast all about women's wealth. Women's wealth is growing faster than men's. As women in the next generation rise in financial power, women will fundamentally change the meaning of legacy. Women as singles, mothers, wives, or widows not only need access to a full continuum of opportunities to save, invest, and preserve financial assets, they also need access to financial education and coaching, coupled with affordable and appropriate savings and credit building products at key times in their lives. Join us on Women Acquiring Assets and learn the stepping stones to home ownership, investment properties, cryptocurrency, business development, and learn all about saving stocks and so much more. Let's grow our networks together.
Welcome to this week's edition of Women Acquiring Assets. I'm your host, Annika Jackson, and today I am here with Tammy Thompson. Welcome, Tammy.
Wow, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this interview.
Me too. I love everything you stand for. First, let me say that.
Thank you.
You are the perfect person for this podcast because Women Acquiring Assets is part of Women's Inflection Point and Equity Movement. Mm-hmm. And it's all about helping people gain sound financial footing, but also realizing when we have to make those pivots, right? What those look like. And if you don't have, you know, spiritual health, mental health, physical health, emotional health, the financial wealth doesn't matter.
That's right.
So please tell our audience about your company and what you do.
Oh boy.
Oh. I know we could talk about this for hours, but
I will keep it concise. I started my consulting business, honestly, back in 2009 or so. I really was interested in helping specifically Black women get more information about becoming a first-time home buyer. So I was really, really interested in real estate. Real estate has always been at the heart of me. I just love getting people, specifically people who never thought they would become a homeowner.
Oh, yeah.
An opportunity to become a homeowner. You know, I've been homeless before. I've been housing insecure a lot. And homeownership has just always been something that I love getting folks connected to. And so I just started, working with people that I knew who were considering homeownership and who wanted to just get the real information that they needed to know. And that sort of progressed into working with organizations. And I had always worked a 9-to-5 job. So this was just really something that I was doing on the side. Mm. And in about 2013 or so, I got fired from a job where I was offering financial literacy programming.
Oh, wow.
Developing programming and home ownership programming as a full-time gig.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I was going to do consulting full time and started working with local nonprofits here in Pittsburgh, offering home ownership programming specifically for low income families, because I really do think that there's a certain skill set that you have to have in working with people who have sort of been taught that some of these opportunities are not for them.
Exactly.
Right, people go through life thinking, oh, well, that's not for me, so I'm not really going to focus on that. I don't have the credit. I don't have the income. And I wanted to be like, no, you can. You can do it, and here's how you can do it. But I realized that there were a lot of organizations that were offering this programming that weren't doing it from the perspective that I had as a person who had experienced poverty in this way.
Right.
And so the program was very specific to the psychology of poverty and what long-term exposure to poverty does to people, specifically around wealth-building initiatives.
It is so hard. I think even, you know, it doesn't matter if you grow up with no money, if you're middle class, whatever, you still feel that there are those barriers and people are not teaching. Because I remember, I mean, thinking about a lot of things, like in high school, my mom's an immigrant, you know, she didn't know about student loans and scholarships and all those things. And so my parents were very, I had all these aspirations and they're very clear, like, no, you're going to stay in Kansas. This is what you're going to do. You're going to go here because your dad teaches there. So you can get, you know, so they were just thinking about things in a different way. And I ended up figuring it out later on my own. But the same thing for home ownership. I was working. I was like, I can't afford to buy anything. And then I was like, oh, wait, but after I talked to somebody who actually could talk to me through it, right, and give me the real education, it's like, oh, I could buy something.
That's right.
And you start somewhere, and that's the whole point. And there are lots of programs that you can get access to, but it's all about making sure people understand how to access them.
That's exactly right. But even larger than that, right? The financial aspect is extremely important, but the psychological and emotional component is even more important. Mm-hmm. Because if people don't believe that it is for them, it's not going to matter how much education you put in front of them. It's not going to matter how much information you give them. If they have been convinced, if they have a perspective that this is just something that's not for people like me, it's not going to happen. So I started developing this psychology of poverty training based on my own experiences in poverty, based on a lot of the issues that I was coming. You know, I was making decent money, but I was still falling into a lot of the mental traps that poverty can create. I had a horrible personal relationship with money. And so I started talking to a lot of the clients that I was working with who were coming from similar backgrounds and sharing a lot of my own personal experiences and my own personal traumas. And people could resonate. It was resonating, right? It was connecting. People were connecting with that information. And it changed the way that I was offering financial education and the way that I was presenting these technical terms and skills related to wealth building. And so I just started developing programs that had at the core of it the psychology of poverty. And people loved it. And it was like, yes, now I get it. And somebody understands where I'm coming from. Right. So they started loosening up. They started being more transparent about their financial situations, about things that were haunting them, that were preventing them from making good financial decisions. And we just started seeing a lot of success with people, you know, who were like, thank God, you know, I found this program because I just, I didn't feel like anybody understood where I was coming from.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started developing other tools. I created a spending log for people who need to really gain control of their spending. And it's just as simple as for a lot of folks, they just need to write everything down, right? Yes, there's a lot of technical apps that exist, but for people who are just starting to take this journey and who are coming into this journey with a lot of personal baggage, sometimes writing is the best way to address it, because there's something about writing that has an emotional connection that texting or typing or looking at an app just doesn't give you. And so because most people's issues are emotionally charged, the writing has really helped, and people love the spending log. Wow. You know, I run into somebody in a grocery store like, I'm using my spending log. You know, a lot more connected to my spending. And I know that it worked for me. It was the one tool that really set me on the right financial track. So I published that tool a while ago. And then I started in the work that I was doing and working specifically with low-income women and women who were really, really working through their poverty trauma, I realized as a nonprofit practitioner that there were a lot of folks who were doing similar work that I was doing who did not have a solid understanding of poverty. They weren't understanding that poverty was not just about money or how much money somebody had, but it was a lot more to do with their experiences and how those experiences were impacting them mentally and psychologically. And just in the work, I was just coming across a lot of people who didn't have that understanding, and I was getting frustrated. And so I woke up one morning and said, you know what? I'm going to start a documentary.
Oh, wait.
Right. Really? I did. And it was interesting because I had never even considered. I have no training in filmmaking. I have absolutely zero experience.
But you have the passion. You have the heart, and you're doing that heart work, right? Absolutely. That's what you were called to do.
That's right. And I also understood the importance of storytelling.
Yeah.
Right? So even if, you know, somebody doesn't quite understand how something works, if they can see a story, right, if they can hear a story, it really changes the way that they view a person or an environment or a system. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, we're going to make a movie. We're going to show people. These are real people that we're talking about. You know, when you think about poverty statistics, somehow we've gotten so disconnected from the fact that there's real people attached to those numbers and those reports and all the stuff that comes out talking about poverty, but there's real people attached to that. So I started, doing some research and trying to figure out how do you do a documentary? And it just so happens that I had worked with an amazing filmmaker named Michael Savisky, who is just incredible, who had done some promo videos for the organization, the nonprofit that I was working for. And I was like, well, if I do this, I only want to do it with Michael, because I could tell that Michael had the heart for the work. And I really was trying to be honest, find a way to get out of it. Right? Because I was like terrified, like, this is not something I can do. So let me just make some really high goals here so that I can have a justification for not doing it. And I knew that Michael was busy, and I also knew that Michael was expensive. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to him, and he was like, yeah, I want to do it. And I was like, oh, okay.
There you go. You tried to put roadblocks up, and God said, nope.
That's exactly right. But then the next roadblock was, okay, well, Michael's in, but how am I going to pay for him? Because he's not cheap. So I went to one of the foundations, the Heinz Endowments, that's located here in Pittsburgh. And I was expecting them to say no. And they agreed to fund the entire project.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was like, okay, well, now I really have to do this thing. And so I just made a couple of posts on Facebook asking people, were they willing to share their poverty experience? Mm-hmm. And I was expecting maybe 5 or 10 people to respond, because I know people don't really like talking about this, right? Mm-hmm. Society has created this environment where people feel they should be ashamed and they should be guilty and they should be embarrassed about living in poverty. But we got almost 60 women who reached out and said, yes, I would like to share. We just started doing focus groups, and we ended up selecting these 3 amazing women that are in the film. And it was, everything happened exactly the way that it was supposed to happen.
Are they all from Pittsburgh?
They're all from Pittsburgh. Okay. Beautiful shots of our city, but also really showing people, this is how hard people are working to get out of poverty. And this, even for the women in the film who actually are no longer considered living in poverty because they've changed their circumstances and they worked really hard to get out, mm-hmm. they still carry the emotional baggage. They still mm-hmm. carry the trauma, and it still impacts them to this day.
And so breaking the cycle of poverty isn't just about being able to buy a house or being
exactly
able.
Right.
It is that feeling.
Yes. So I'm really, really proud of this film, which, by the way, is called We Wear the Mask.
I'm just going to ask.
Yes, We Wear the Mask, The Hidden Face of Poverty. I'm really happy we were able to get it on Amazon back in October.
Ooh, congratulations.
Yes, thank you. We just want people to see it. We want as many people to see it as possible, because I really think it's creating an environment of empathy around mm-hmm. poverty that needs to exist more in this society. We need to see that negative narrative that I think exists in our society, where if people are in poverty, it's because they haven't worked hard enough,
right.
They don't want it bad enough, or they're not intelligent, or they're just lazy and they want somebody to be taken care of. It's a horrible negative narrative that just isn't true. And I think this film represents that in a really beautiful way. And it shows how hard these women are working and are willing to work to do, to get their themselves and their families in a better situation. Yeah, so
really
I'm really proud of it. I'm very, very proud of it. And so now, the business focuses, we do a lot of public speaking around the topic of poverty, do a ton of lecturing at universities and speaking at conferences and doing trainings to help folks who work specifically with a demographic of poverty to understand the people that you are working with, to mm-hmm. understand really the layered the layered issues that come with living in poverty, and also understanding the policies and systems that help perpetuate it.
Oh, yes.
Right. So, you know, there's this thought that poverty is not an individual issue. It's not about personal accountability all the time. Mm-hmm. Personal accountability is extremely important, but it also requires us to be looking at the policies and systems that exist that were created to keep people in poverty.
Exactly.
And that continue to perpetuate that. So it's not just enough to point the finger at people who are suffering in poverty. We have to be collectively thinking about solutions. And in order to have those solutions, you've got to understand the root causes and really understand what people are dealing with when they're trying to get out.
Yeah. And there's, we could go on about this. I could go off on so many tangents all day long.
Yeah.
Because there are so many associated things, right? So what you're talking about, the systems that were put in place. Mm. I was just on a, helping with a panel yesterday that was about policing and protesting and how the what the origin of the police was and how it was, you know, to keep slaves from running away.
That's
and then it was to keep immigrants who were coming over, even white immigrants, from, you know, being riffraff or getting involved with the people who were also immigrants, but were already here before them. But it was really about keeping people down and keeping poor people poor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it wasn't the way that we view what the police's role is now, but there's still so much of that ingrained.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what you're saying. It's like, you have to really, we have to blow up every system, the educational system, how people are trained in school, you know, the way the school system works and the days work is so that you are used to a schedule to work in a factory. It's That's not right. for you to expand your mind and think about what other things you can do in life.
Yes, so, all of the systems need a complete overhaul. I mean, if you really think about the system, all of them were created in a time where anybody who wasn't considered rich was a second class or third or fourth class citizen. And every one of those systems that we use to this day were created and built on that platform. So, you know, it's sort of intrinsic in the system. It's intrinsic in the policies that exist. And we have to be aware of that before, you know, we can't be thinking about solutions for these issues with not understanding that. And the very sad part about that is the people who are actually the victim of a lot of these systems, they don't even realize that they're caught up in this. And so we do a lot of work, you know, discussing our history, discussing the history of this country, and helping people make the connection between what's happening in their lives and how these systems were built. And that's important because the guilt and the shame that a lot of people are carrying is such a weight around their neck. It's such a weight that it prevents people from seeing opportunity, right? It prevents people from seeing their possibilities.
Right.
And so you got to tear down a lot of the walls and you got to peel back a lot of layers to show people, yes, okay, this might be the life that you were born into, but that doesn't really, you know, it's not who you are, right? It's not, it's only your circumstance, your current condition doesn't mean it's your forever condition.
Yes.
And here's the things that can happen for you. And, you know, I get it. And my experiences, I've been homeless, I've been food insecure, I've been, you know, I had a really rough childhood and a young adult life where the bulk of my life I spent in poverty trying to get out. And so the weight of that can be, it can be a shackle on you and how you see the world and most importantly, how you see yourself.
And the fact that you took your own lived experience and were able to say, I recognize that I can use my experience to help other people break these cycles. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's really, really important.
But it's not really a lot of people, not everybody does that. Not everybody connects their passion and purpose and their life lessons.
Yeah, I don't think we've been taught as a society to recognize our some of our, you know, struggles with power, right? There's power in experience. There's power in struggle, even if it's been tough, even if the hardest thing, because somebody else is experiencing the exact same thing and needs to hear and see that they can get out. And so in order for people to see that, the folks who've endured it and who have survived it have to be willing to be open and honest and transparent and share that. Because we, you know, I'm the executive director of a nonprofit here, right? I own my own business. But people who don't know me and who didn't know me back when I could barely pay my rent and who, you know, when I couldn't put food on the table, those people might meet me and just think, yes, this has happened.
Yeah. You know,
I didn't. I worked really hard, but I also was blessed with opportunity and you know, building social capital and finding ways to get in the door. Mm-hmm. And anybody can do that. I'm not special.
I beg to differ. I think, what you're doing is very powerful. And I want to take a quick commercial break and come back to this conversation. So we'll be right back.
Women's Inflection Point is a nonprofit, educational, and results-driven entity providing women a success path to reach maximum potential in each of their life cycle stages. Women's Inflection Point focuses on three tiers of Maslow's hierarchy of needs pyramid: human wellness, safety, and self-actualization. In other words, we focus on your health, your money, and yourself. An inflection point is an event that results in dramatic and significant change. Our mission is to facilitate occurrences of inflection points that activate unleashed potential to propel women to reach their maximum potential in all aspects of their life. These occurrences are delivered at events throughout the year in organic and diverse, inclusive environments. For more information, visit us at www.womeninflectionpoint.org.
And we are back on Women Acquiring Assets. I am Annika Jackson, and I'm here with Tammy Thompson from T3 Consulting. Now, you have your consulting business. You also have you're executive director of a nonprofit. You just are truly amazing for the way that you're tackling the issue of poverty, helping people understand what generational wealth can look like, home ownership, all of those things. And your film, so it's local to Pittsburgh. Have you thought about, or has anybody reached out to you about doing the same thing for other cities?
Well, that's what I'm looking for, right? That's the hope is, expand the viewership into, now that it's on Amazon, we're really, really hoping. I've been watching our analytics a little bit. I try not to focus on it too much. But we've had folks from all over the country and even in some other countries view the film. So I'm really hoping, because this is really translatable in any part of this country in particular. There's poverty all over this country, and it's deeply rooted in a lot of our country. I'm hoping that people will utilize the film and they will see something that's going to spark an idea to create some solutions. That's really my goal.
Feeling that's going to happen very soon for you. I'm already thinking about who do I know who could help push this forward even more. Your curriculum as well, the things I want to ask you about the shift during COVID, because I know I'm in California, we're still pretty shut down. Yeah. My daughter goes to virtual school.
All of our kids are too. Yeah, we're basically the same here. You know, we've been pretty much shut down since March. I can't believe it's been almost a year that we've been enduring this. And families are really hurting. You know, one thing that COVID really did was highlight and magnify a lot of inequities in our systems that show that a lot of people who are struggling now were already struggling pre-COVID.
Right.
And this just made it worse. And some of our systems and policies need some efficiency changes. We need to make getting people help easier.
Yeah.
We need to support families in a different way. Our education system is suffering like you wouldn't believe. You know, it's hard to believe that in the 21st century, you know, here we are, and kids didn't have laptops.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Right, and so we spent, I feel like we spent so much time just trying to make sure everybody had a laptop
and access to steady internet.
Access to the internet and all of these things that I guess that people, again, when you don't stay deeply connected with the most vulnerable populations, I think people just assumed that everybody had these things already, which didn't make any sense. So, you know, I really want us to do better. We've got to do better in addressing the needs of our vulnerable populations. We've got to stay more connected with real, true needs and solutions for some of these. No,
nobody. You need to run for office. We need somebody like you.
I've been asked a couple of times. I do not have the temperament for politics.
But that's exactly why we need you.
I don't have time for the energy for the nonsense that comes with politics. You know, I like to actually get stuff done.
I get it. So, but with COVID, I know you're seeing changes in how it's affecting populations that were already in crisis.
Yeah.
Are you able to expand and reach more people? Because we're on Zoom all day, right? So you can
absolutely. You know, what's really interesting. So we offer, because we offer a lot of workshops and a lot of our work has been one-on-one counseling. Mm-hmm. We were immediately able to convert all of our stuff on a virtual platform.
Amazing.
But we never had to stop offering our programming. Everything still continued virtually. And of course, it took people a while to get used to that. Mm-hmm. But once they did, we actually, when we reviewed our numbers late last year, we had been seeing and serving more people in 2020 than we had in our previous 2 years of operating.
Amazing.
So it was like either people now had the time to, you know, and the opportunity to sit through a virtual workshop, or people just saw a certain urgency, right? People were like, okay, I've been wanting to be a homeowner for a long time, and now they're sitting at home and around like, okay, it's time for me to make this happen. Or, you know, I just feel like people felt like this was a very scary thing, and nobody knew what the future was going to hold. And people were like, whatever was on my list to get done, I want to start working on it right now. So that was beautiful. And we also served a lot of people who have never had a need for any of these resources before. Right? We had people who were crying because they had to come and get diapers and formula for their baby, who had never had any issues financially before. People who needed food, who had never been able to, had never had a need to navigate, you know, a food bank or a food pantry. And that was tough. It was tough, I think, for people. I think it was tougher for folks who had never experienced anything like this before, because, you know, and I'll just be quite honest, a lot of those folks were people who felt those negative things about people in poverty before. And now when they realize, wait, we all are just one disaster away from it all crumbling down and needing support and resources from our community. So, you know, I've been trying to stay optimistic, even though it's hard to stay optimistic during COVID. But I'm hoping that there's been a shift in how people view their neighbors, how we view each other, how we recognize that no matter what is happening, if we look to be able to provide, if I have two loaves of bread, I should be able to give one to my neighbor.
Yeah.
Because we can't depend on the government to save us all the time.
Like, no, we can't.
We have these resources in our communities. And if we just give a little bit of what we have to each other, I think we can really change the landscape of what's happening in our communities.
I think so too. One of the things, COVID has lifted up so many things that really needed a light shined on them that have been happening, but people were at home and able to see them. And we're almost forced to pay attention.
Right.
Thank goodness, right? Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it's made, you know, I live in a neighborhood where we have to walk the dogs, or we get, you know, just need to get out and get some fresh air. And people are doing that, and everybody's nice to each other.
Yes.
And it's so, I feel like I've gotten to know my neighbors better during this time, even though it's not like we're sitting across the table, but we're able to say hi. We're able to wear our masks and, you know, and talk on the street for a minute.
That's been one of the benefits, is that it's sort of slowed it down for people. We've all been running around in this rat race and not paying attention to what's happening around us. And what that, you know, that isolates us. It isolates us. It sort of minimizes our humanity a little bit when we're running around and being hyper-focused on what we need to do next and where we need to be next. And I just saw so much love. People who, you know, were just stepping up and supporting each other, and organizations that we had never partnered with before were reaching out. We were getting tons of donations to support the work. It really was beautiful. It was a beautiful spot in a very ugly year, to be able to see how people, what the power of what could happen when people work together.
Exactly. The collaborations. Yeah. That's something else that I've really noticed a lot of. But going back to what you were saying about, you know, people could look at you and not understand your story and your journey and the power of story.
Yeah.
And that makes, I mean, as somebody in PR marketing, everything is about story.
That's right.
You know, but also I've been that person who, you know, was married to somebody who had a really good job, made a lot of money. I could do all the things, give all the money to charity, do whatever, you know. And then I've also been the person who was divorced and went to Walmart to get food and had, you know, didn't have any money.
Yeah.
And got denied and had the manager feel called to make sure that I could take home something. I've been on both sides of that. And I think when you have experienced that, well, you have to remember where you came from and you have to remember all sides, right?
That's
because
right.
I know a lot of people also who have been there, but then they don't even act like it. And the person they are now, I'm like, how can you not remember where you came from?
That's exactly right. But so, society has a way of doing that to people, right? Because let's just be real. You know, I've been in spaces where I am the only Black woman. I have been in spaces where I am the only Muslim woman. I have been in spaces where I am the only person who has experienced these things. And because people don't, you know, might not necessarily know my story, they'll start talking about these issues in such a negative way that I could either do two things. I could be quiet and just try to assimilate and maintain, because I don't know, will they judge me? Will they look at me differently? Will they think I'm no longer qualified for this work if they know where I come from? Or I could speak up and speak out and say, wait a minute, hold up. Those are my people that you're talking about. I am that person that you're talking about. And unfortunately, a lot of people will choose the first option. They won't say anything because sometimes they feel like their livelihood is on the line.
Right.
You know, maybe now some people, instead of looking at me and recognizing me for my talent and what I can bring to the table, they're more focused on pitying me, or now I don't seem so bright and shiny because I've experienced poverty. It happens. People in this country have been taught to judge, shame, and guilt people in poverty. And so there's a lot of reasons why people move out of a neighborhood and don't come back for other people. There's a reason people leave and don't reach a hand back, because they don't want to be associated with that thing, or they may be escaping their own trauma.
That's true.
Because that neighborhood, I'm traumatized by what I experienced there, so I don't come back. And I try to change who I am and completely alter my persona because I don't want to be connected to that trauma anymore. So there's a lot of reasons why people do it, but I strongly urge and encourage people, tell your story. Tell your story, because people need to see that there is light at the end of the tunnel. There are people who are stuck who need to know that, okay, all right, maybe I can just keep taking one step. Maybe I can keep taking another step because they did it. And I just strongly believe in
you. You are so preaching to the choir. That is what I tell everyone I work with. You know, I don't think there is an option anymore.
That's right.
After this, what we've seen this year, there is only one option. Be yourself, be authentic, live in your truth, share your truth. If you see something that you don't like, say something.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
Because otherwise nothing is ever going to change in the society.
And I really do believe that there are more good people in this country than there are bad.
Yeah.
Really, I just believe that, you know, we don't always hear from them for various reasons, but I still am optimistic enough. I don't know how after 51 years in this country, but I am still optimistic enough to believe that there are more good people who want to do something, who want to do the right thing, who want to reach back and help somebody else and bring them along with them. I want to believe that.
Well, I agree with you, but I do have to throw something back to you. You are so amazing and optimistic, and you do so much for others. I noticed when my pre-interview questions, you're not very good at self-care.
I am not.
So I wanted to see what You know, what do you do or what will you do for yourself for self-care? And then also, how can people help you? How can somebody go to your website, find you, watch the movie, you know, get involved with the work that you're doing and help change the narrative?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So, you know, I am a mother of 5 children. I started having children when I was 17 years old. So I have been a mother for almost 34 years. And you know, during a time where it was really, really hard for me, and there just wasn't time to take care of myself. And I was sort of told by society, really, I was already stigmatized by being a teenage mother, that it wasn't about me anymore, right? It doesn't matter what I want or what I need. You put everything into your children, and I had something to prove. And so that, unfortunately, was geared towards putting everything into other people. And, I talked to my therapist about this a lot. Now I'm 51 years old, and I don't know how to take care of myself because I've been taking care of other people my entire life. So it's baby steps for me, you know? It's baby steps. I was on vacation last week, and I cried almost the whole time because I didn't know what else. I didn't know what to be doing with myself because, you know, that's what I do. I take care of people, and I work. I take care of people.
Right? Preaching to the choir again, and it's hard to turn off. But we have to figure out how to do it because if you don't
have to. And I just said to somebody, it's not a badge of honor to work into the grave. It is actually detrimental to your mental health. So I have committed myself for this second phase of my life to really start doing some of the things that I like to do. And if I don't know what those things are, I have to be intentional about finding out.
Yes.
So I am definitely taking more time off, you know, going when we can ever travel safely again, I will be traveling more and just enjoying, you know, getting to know who I am.
Yeah.
That's really where I'm at right now. So I'm working on it. I'm working on self-care habits. But as far as how you can help, I really appreciate you asking that question. There's a, you know, folks can find me on my website at www.tammytthompson.com. And they can find the film on Amazon Video. So if you're a Prime member, it's free to watch.
Awesome.
If you want to check out my 9-to-5 job, our website is www.catapultpittsburgh.org.
Oh, okay. And I also noticed you're actually in pre-production for another documentary.
I am. So T3 Media is the media company that we started when we decided, hey, this might be a thing. This might be something I'm pretty good at. But we really want to focus on social justice issues, issues that are impacting our communities in a very detrimental way. And so in the film, the first film, We Wear the Mask, we focus a lot on mothers and single mothers and the impact of being a single mother. And quite honestly, here in Pittsburgh, some of our foundation community focuses almost primarily on single mothers and children, which is a beautiful thing to focus on. But I really like solutions and root issues and root causes. And these women did not become single mothers by themselves.
Exactly.
Right. So I'm really interested in telling the story of fathers, particularly Black fathers in our community. So we're in pre-production to just give men an opportunity to talk about fatherhood and what it's like to be a father as a Black man in a city like Pittsburgh and probably around most of the country, and to also point out a lot of the systemic and policy things that impact a Black man being a father in this country.
Yeah.
So, which is leading us down the road of mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot, I'm very interested. I can't wait to tell this story. It's a beautiful story. You know, the very first focus group we did, I had never seen so many beautiful, strong men just crying and holding each other because they're in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And we don't really give men a lot of room to share their traumas.
Well, and you bring up another good point because I also, I was just talking to a client of mine who is from Virginia, grew up in a poor community. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a father, he's a serial entrepreneur. Has a lot of different issues, but he focuses on a lot on mental health because he said in the Black community, mental health is not talked about.
No,
it because it's not prioritized. You did not go to a therapist. You did not have family counseling. And so he is on his own journey. You know, he's like, well, I had mental health facility clinics to help people, but I didn't even realize that I had my own issues.
Yes.
So now he's speaking out about them. Because it does need to be normalized.
Absolutely. It's very important. And you're right. It's been, you know, portrayed as it's a weakness, mm-hmm. right? If you're struggling with your mental health, that means you're weak or you're not praying hard enough, right?
Right.
You can't pray mental illness away.
Right.
And so then people start self-medicating. They become addicted to drugs and alcohol and, mm-hmm. you know, they act out in other ways because they're not given a space to address their mental health issues. And a lot of it is PTSD from long-term yes. exposure to poverty.
Yes.
I keep telling people some of this is the root issue that we haven't either connected or we're not addressing at all. And so I'm really, really strongly focused on just raising awareness around poverty, trauma, and PTSD.
It's amazing. I am going to run and watch your first documentary as soon as I can. And then I can't wait to hear more about the second one and when that comes out. You're really doing amazing work. And
thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really happy that we were able to connect. I have so many ideas that I'll be emailing you about for
I can't wait to see you.
Places you need to meet and panels you need to speak on and just, you know, adding more to your schedule.
That's what I'm here for. So I'm excited about it.
And that's one of the things with Women's Inflection Point, which is the nonprofit that works with equity movement and has Women Acquiring mm-hmm. Assets, which has this podcast. One mm-hmm. of the big components is self-care. So when we get together in person for conferences, we talk about the issues that you're talking about. We talk about real estate. We talk about how to, you know, do different things, but we also take time to unplug. And so hopefully we'll be able to get back together in, you know, the next year or so. And I hope that I can meet you in person and you can come to one of those conferences and, you know, maybe be a speaker, do some stuff, but then also take some time to unwind a little bit, go get a massage, you know.
Conferencing is one of my favorite things to do. Really a great way to combine work and vacation at the same time.
Exactly.
I love it.
Tammy, thank you so much for your time today. I just really appreciated having this conversation. You're doing so much amazing work, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was my pleasure to be here.
So this has been another episode of Women Acquiring Assets, and we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Annika Jackson. At Annika PR, we provide public relations strategy, content marketing, and brand and design services. We are gifted with the ability to draw excitement to an event, brand, or concept. Don't just take our word for it. See our clients' work in Forbes, CNN, Amazon TV shows, and much more. Want your brand amplified? Go to AnnikaPR.com. That's AnnikaPR.com.
Well, that's it for this episode. To learn more about who we are and what we do, visit www.womeninflectionpoint.org/WAA. If you have anything you'd like to share, Annika would love to hear from you. And she can be reached at info@womeninflectionpoint.org. Be sure to tune in every week for another episode and learn more about how financial assets are a store of resources that women and families can tap into, particularly during emergencies, and how wealth can provide a nest egg that can be leveraged into investments like a home, an investment property, or a business, and then can be passed on to future generations. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.